Hello again to everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and I am very pleased to welcome you to the teleclass, MRSA in Healthcare Facilities, The Growing Burden. Our faculty today is very well qualified to speak to the subject of MRSA. Dr. Susan Huang came very strongly recommended by a friend at the CDC who considers Dr. Huang to be a worldwide expert on this topic. She works with the University of California at the Irvine Medical Center. And until recently, she was an assistant professor at the Harvard Medical School and an infectious disease physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Huang's current work focuses on two areas related to hospital-associated infections. She is involved with the work on hospital-associated transmission of MRSA, particularly including the evaluation of risk factors leading to spread of these organisms within the hospital and also downstream from the hospital in community and long-term care and so on. And secondly, she has interests in improving the way in which healthcare-associated infections are defined, both in terms of efficiency and accuracy, as well as completeness of reporting. It's a real honor to have Dr. Huang present this teleclass, MRSA in Healthcare Facilities, The Growing Burden, and I'll let her get to it. From the University of California, I give you Dr. Susan Huang.
Hello, and thank you for the invitation. Today I'll be focusing on general epidemiology of MRSA as it might be noted in a variety of hospitals and nursing homes, and talking a little bit about what's been happening with the MRSA reservoir. So I believe that you should have received a PDF version of these slides, and I'll be going through those, and I'll be letting you know as we change slides. So if you would go ahead and change to the second slide, the four things that I hope to cover in this hour are to talk about the scope of the problem and to really have it be a little bit more clearly defined about what really happens to people and how much of a problem is there. And to talk about the impact of MRSA carriage versus infection, what does it matter if you're carrying it around but not actively infected? And the changing reservoir of what's been happening as different types of strains come to the forefront, particularly the community-associated strains. And finally, what are some options for response? And I'll just mention that in a brief hour, I'll try to do some general justice to all of these, but obviously each of these things is a very large discussion in and of themselves. So the next slide. What we know about Staphylococcus aureus has been known for about a century, that about 30% of people carry Staph aureus, and they harbor it in their nose, and in general, it doesn't do a whole lot unless given the opportunity to do so. The methicillin-resistant form, which we know of as MRSA, was first noted in the UK around the late 60s and then rapidly thereafter in the US in the late 60s as well. And then it was fairly quiet and a rare event until around the 1980s when it started to take off with a real rapidity throughout the US. And it was really seen in the 1980s and even in the early 1990s as really the quintessential hospital-acquired pathogen. It really wasn't seen in any other venue. It was commonly a source of outbreaks. It was resistant to many growing antibiotics, not just the beta-lactam class. And it was felt that there was some concern that it might go from there to the community, but that it was really seen as a hospital-associated issue. And, of course, we know that that has dramatically changed. So I'm going to initially start with healthcare-associated MRSA, which is where most of my comments will be restricted to. And I'll talk about the hospital and the nursing home. So if you go ahead and go to the next slide that has a figure on it. This figure is very common. It's commonly used, and it is a very well-known slide from the CDC. And it really shows what's been happening to the proportions of Staph aureus infections in ICUs. what fraction of Staph aureus infections are due to methicillin-resistant strains. And you can see that that proportion has been steadily rising from the 1990s into the present day, where it really clears about 65% of infections in ICU patients on average. If you have a Staph aureus infection, it would be a resistant form. And so it's been really the dominant strain, not strain, but the dominant form that is resistance versus susceptible across the U.S. for some time. And just so that we don't stay completely U.S.-centric, the next slide shows you that this is also true in Canada, where they're seeing a substantial rise in a number of provinces, and certainly true across large areas of Europe, although not all. So the next slide, which is labeled UK Staph aureus deaths, I like to show this slide because it helps us understand one critical thing about Staph aureus epidemiology, and that is, when MRSA first came into the picture, there was a great hope that the methicillin-resistant form would somehow just kind of supplant some of the susceptible forms, and the total burden of Staph aureus would remain the same. And it's very clear, both in the UK and in other places like the US, that that has not happened, that instead these hatched bars, which represent MRSA, have actually been added above and beyond the amount of stable, susceptible infections that have been seen, so that the total burden of Staph aureus has been steadily accruing over time. And that's really what has led us to a number of problematic issues. Currently, for both those reasons, which was a hospital-acquired issue, that those were rising in hospital-acquired settings, but also because of the community-associated burden that's rising, we have seen the following. So if you go to the next slide, which details U.S. burden estimates, these are estimates that are obtained largely from claims data, so there are some caveats to them, looking for people who may have had some sort of ICD-9 or procedure code that indicates Staph aureus infections along with a resistance code. But if you look at the number of hospitalizations by these coding criteria, you'll notice that they have more than doubled between the year 2000 and 2005, so that MRSA is, at least by coded data, seen in about 278,000 hospitalizations, accounting for about 56,000 septic events and ultimately about 18,000 deaths in the U.S. each year. So the next slide leads me to this general comment about, you know, what happens to you if you, and I mean you in terms of a hospitalized patient, what happens to hospitalized patients when they acquire MRSA? And it's a real important question because as the prevalence has been rising, some areas and regions and countries have asked, well, you know, it's already all over the place, why do we bother to do anything anymore? And I think the question really lies on, you know, are they at higher risk for something to happen to them? Should you really try to stem the tide even though it is rising and rising very rapidly or ending up with a very high prevalence rate? So post-acquisition studies that have been done over the past 10 and maybe now 15 years have shown that in the hospital setting, and particularly among risky patients like ICU patients or tertiary care patients, that the risk of having someone be a identified colonized patient, their risk of developing infection during that same hospital stay is substantial. That is, it is about somewhere between 10, 15, maybe even 20% among kind of whole house inpatients. And in ICU patients, it can be as high as 30 to 40% of people who will develop a subsequent bacteremic event. So it's quite surprising. And we've done some work in the next slide that will say, well, if you look at a tertiary care center, this is work from Brigham and Women's Hospital, what is the chance that if you are newly identified as a carrier of MRSA, this is whole house, not just limited to the ICU, but anywhere in that facility, what is the chance that they will develop invasive disease based upon chart-reviewed CDC criteria over the next 18 months coming back to that facility? So this is naturally an underestimate. It only talks about people who get sick and come back to Brigham and Women's Hospital, and we know that people seek care in a variety of places. But in the next 18 months, how many of them get sick? And the answer is that 29% of them, this is again tertiary care patients, will develop a new event related to MRSA. And of those new events, 28% of them involve bloodstream issues. And so these are serious events, and half of them occur post-discharge. So when you hear someone say in your hospital, well, we see people who are colonized with MRSA all the time, and they come and they're colonized, and they leave and they're colonized, and they're fine. We all know that with today's shortening lengths of stay, where people are staying for 3, 4, maybe 5 days, that the chance that something will come back in the post-discharge setting is higher and higher and higher. And the issue is, unless you're the primary care provider, you may not fully appreciate the sequelae that can happen with this organism, particularly in people who are high risk. That is, people who require a lot of medical care because they have devices, they have wounds, they're unable to really contain secretions or use really good hygienic procedures at home or do a proper bathing. So, or have nicks or cuts or bruises or other risks for portals of entry. So we've also shown, and you don't have a slide to suggest this, but we've also presented in abstract form data that suggests that if you look at people and no matter where they go, that is, if you identify people who are MRSA positive, at a major tertiary care center, and then track them by claims to whatever facility they've gone to in the next year, so not even 18 months, but the next year, and you request records from all those facilities and say, did they have an MRSA event? Actually, the number is about 30% in 12 months, not 18 months. So it really looks like if you have a high-risk patient population, this can really do an extraordinary amount of subsequent disease, to the point where, you know, we're talking about reducing harm or reducing infections in about 1 in 3 people. And so I usually make the comparison that, you know, when we give heart medication for giving aspirin or cholesterol-lowering agents, you know, we talk about benefits in 1 in 100 or 1 in a couple of 100. And so really thinking about what we can do to prevent something that's as high as 1 in 3 really raises the bar of saying that something probably should be done. I'm going to switch gears now and talk a little bit about the nursing home. And I will first want to attribute a large number of the slides that are presented here to Dr. Koenig at U Wisconsin, who's done a really nice amount of work in nursing homes, and we're starting to do some of those as well. But he really has been seen in many ways as a very focused expert in this field. So I'll start by this graph that shows us that U.S. long-term care continues to rise. And we know this because hospitalized care is continuing to become shorter and shorter in terms of length of stay. So a lot of serious medical care is being taken care of in rehab centers, sometimes skilled nursing facilities, and through home health. So our population is increasing not just because they're utilized more, but also because we have an aging population. And again, this is U.S. care. And then I'm going to, the next slide tells us a little bit about this same question. That is, if you have carriers, what are their risks of infection? So I've largely been talking about the risks of infections while someone's in an ICU or while someone's in a tertiary care hospital setting. You know, what is it after they're a little bit more stable and now in a nursing home? And so this particular slide tells you about a study that was published by Ann Bradley in Annals of Internal Medicine in 1991. So it's an old study that was done in the Michigan VA nursing home. And they screened several hundred patients on admission and monthly, and they found that 20% of people imported MRSA, and there's even a more recent study that came out in Clinical Infectious Diseases, I believe it was also in Michigan, that showed upwards of 40% of people were carrying MRSA on admission. And of these, 14% of negative patients acquired MRSA, so that the overall MRSA prevalence over time was about 23%. And what I wanted to highlight is when they followed these people throughout their stay in this nursing home, about 11% of them developed infection, and at least half of those infections required rehospitalization in an acute care facility. So even when you leave the hospital, if you're still sick enough to be in a nursing home, your risk is still substantial. That is, we're still talking about a 1 in 9 risk of developing serious infection after an acute stay. The next slide suggests the same thing. Again, this is a study done by Bob Muter's group showing that your risk of staying infection-free is less if you're MRSA colonized in nursing homes versus if you're colonized by MSSA, the sensitive form, or if you have no staff at all. And you can see that these curves are widely divergent and that those who have MRSA really less than half of them remain free of infection after a year. The next slide is also a study that was looked at, again, in nursing home patients, and it just highlights that they did a fairly comprehensive look at what types of infections are these people getting. So this was a prospective cohort study of almost 3,000 patients, and what they were finding is that most of the infections that are acquired are related to the respiratory tract. And we know this from work that we've done that the most common infections, about a third of them fall into the pneumonia category, another third fall into some sort of wound class category. And not just talking about community-associated MRSA, but general hospital-associated MRSA, still a lot of wound infections that meet CDC criteria and are truly classified as wound infections, not colonization. And then a third of them involve other things, still substantial infections, bone and joint, sepsis, bacteremias due to secondary causes other than those that I mentioned. The next slide also suggests that mortality is divergent, again, in people who are MRSA carriers versus those who are not. And again, instead of just looking at infection, this suggests that there is a death risk among those who are MRSA positive. Now, for both these things that I've mentioned to you in the hospitalized setting and in the nursing home study, we know that there are host factors that are at play here. That is, and we do know that sicker groups of patients tend to get MRSA colonized. And so some of the infection risk and the mortality risk is because these people are very sick. And what I haven't provided you with, and the data really isn't available, is, you know, what would they have died of anyways if you removed the MRSA? So we know that a good number of them will die with MRSA, but, you know, would they have died of an E. coli infection if you removed some of the MRSA? So that hasn't been well studied because it's very hard to know. It's really, really hard to do a good full adjustment. But the bottom line is just by sheer numbers, MRSA is a substantial perpetrator in both hospitals and nursing homes. So the next section that I'm going to talk about, and again, I'll divide it again into the hospital and the nursing home setting, is this phenomenon that has really started to be seen widely across the U.S. through legislative mandates and has been a source of great controversy, which is, you know, how common really is MRSA and should we screen? And I'll give you some of the evidence here, and then I'll later talk about a lot of the different options, and not all of which involve screening, but I'll talk about the different options that people have used, and I'll try to limit my comments just to show you that there are multiple things that can be done. There are benefits of screening, and whether or not it is widely applicable to every single population really still is not scientifically known, although there are certain populations at which it appears to have benefit. So the next slide is titled The Iceberg Phenomenon, and it's a graph that a figure that was presented by Barry Farr in Lancet Infectious Diseases a number of years ago, and it just shows you what we all know, which is that, you know, if you only look at people who have clinical disease, and it's also true if you just look at people who have clinical cultures, that is, a doctor is worried about something and therefore sends a culture, it really is only the tip of the iceberg compared to people who are carriers. So people who are colonized with MRSA often are 50% to 100%, if you look at some of the European studies, are missed if you just use clinical cultures alone. And so that's where this desire to talk about screening arose from, this question about whether or not if you can identify people who have it and do some sort of isolation practice, that is, gown and glove use, put them in a single room, you know, then maybe you'll protect the other very sick people around them from being so exposed to them so that MRSA doesn't get out of control. So it's about prevention of MRSA to others. Screening clearly doesn't do anything for the person who has it, and there are other interventions that would need to be done. So let's first talk about the hospital And I'll talk first about what we know about the hidden reservoir. So again, active surveillance studies both in the U.S. and in Europe have shown that it increases detection about 30 to 50%. There are some studies that suggest even 100%, a twofold increase in the amount of MRSA that's seen can be identified if you do routine screening. So largely these studies have been done in ICU settings where the risk of finding people who are carriers is higher, the prevalence is higher, and of course the risk of disease is greater. There are newer studies over the past several years done in the U.S., particularly by M. Lance Peterson's group in Chicago, that really look at whole house screening. And I won't go into the resource implications of all of that, but they also find that they detect substantially more, but of course the total prevalence is much lower. So in an ICU setting, you might detect, for example, somewhere between 15 and 20% of people who have it. And in the non-ICU setting, whole house-wide, you might be at 5 to 7%. So it is recommended for high-risk areas in the 2003 SHEA guidelines. It certainly is recommended in nearly all guidelines in response to an uncontained outbreak. If you go to the next slide, I'm going to detail one of the studies that we did, which is the CDC Prevention Epicenters, which is a consortium of academic medical centers dedicated to preventing healthcare-associated infections, wanted to look at the value of screening a couple of years ago. And what they did is we took 12 academic medical center ICUs, some surgical, some medical, and these are ICUs that were undergoing high compliance routine admission and weekly Nares cultures for, in some cases, a number of years. And each of those ICUs contributed about a one-year study period. And we took a look at the measurements with and without surveillance cultures to really get a better sense of, you know, how much is surveillance culture, how much are they helping us? And so if you go to the next slide, you can see this is kind of a very compartmentalized summary slide of what was found. And I think the reference of the paper is also given, so you can actually look it up. But if we just talk about importation, that is how many people bring it in to these ICUs, the estimate is about 12%, which is a good amount, just bringing it into an ICU. 12% of people will have it. And that 12% is actually 50% higher because of screening. So, for example, you would probably think that it is 8%. And if you screen, you get 50% bump, and that'll get you to 12%. Same with acquisition, the estimate with screening is 3.4%, and that is a 31% increase over what you would see without screening cultures. And finally, the overall prevalence, when you sum up the lengths of stay that people have and take a look at the importation and the acquisition rate, is 18% and 31% increase above those estimates without surveillance cultures. So the bottom line is surveillance cultures are producing about a 30 to 50% increase in what you think there is. And so the question is, if you can identify those additional people and rapidly put them into precautions, can you prevent a good number of patients in the ICU from acquiring it for the first time? And then if you prevent them from acquiring it, then they're not subject to this 1 in 3 risk of developing an invasive disease downstream. So later in the presentation, I'll show you a little bit about some of the outcome measures that have been identified using screening. But here I'm just going to show you what's happening to your sense of how much is there. There, on the next slide, I provide 3 studies that did whole house screening, often at great cost. And you can see here that from these studies span from 1998 to 2005, and the housewide prevalence ranges from 2.7% to about 6 to 7% now, and again in tertiary care academic medical centers. Overall, I would say that the value of active surveillance is that it does give you some sense of the knowledge of the iceberg. It certainly increases detection, particularly in high-risk areas. It certainly increases awareness of how much is really out there. It does correct misclassification. That is, instead of you thinking that you gave MRSA to a number of people, a lot of them are actually importing it. And so sometimes it's helpful to just know what their status is on admission so you don't falsely attribute it to your hospital or to your unit. In our study, we found that this is occurring about 17% of the time that we would attribute something to us giving it to them when they actually brought it in. And then again, the value, the intended value for making a change in outcome, of course, is this idea of rapid isolation so that prevention of transmission can occur. So again, I am not at all touching upon the unintended consequences about screening and mandated screening and certainly house-wide screening because it's a huge topic, and there are a number of very well-done papers that have done justice to this topic. I'll highlight one by Dan Dikema and Mike Edmond that's called Look Before You Leap, and I believe that's in Clinical Infectious Diseases. And I was part of a Shea statement about legislative mandates on MRSA that details some of that. So there are clear benefits, and but it's not without cost, and the risk-benefit ratio or the cost-benefit ratio and the resource-benefit ratio really, in my mind, deserves some attention at the institutional facility level. And, of course, a lot of that has been supplanted by legislative mandates. National measures, and I'm going to talk about some of those right now. So I'll talk first about voluntary trends. So there was a real push by the Institute of Healthcare Improvement, that is IHI, through their, and I'm sorry, it says 5,000 lives campaign, it should be 5 million lives campaign, to really encourage facilities to screen in at least one unit. And again, I would agree that the scientific evidence is the most robust for high-risk areas that are ICUs or tertiary care hospitals that have really high-risk patients. So there's a real push for them to encourage people to start to screen. The VA medical centers had a national mandate so that all VA hospitals have received funds to do mandatory MRSA surveillance, initially in their ICUs and now house-wide. And then the CDC has an MDRO module that initially was slated to really encourage people to screen in at least one unit, and I believe they may be relaxing some of that criteria. But again, this is a voluntary module through NHSN. This next slide is a map picture of MRSA legislation in the U.S., and you can see that a number of states have enacted laws, including Illinois, Pennsylvania, California, that will require screening of a really broad set of patients for MRSA. And this has had these are unfunded mandates, and it has had a great amount of implementation challenges, and we have yet to know, because it's early on what the statewide impact will be. So the next slide just details a number of states and what they're doing with MRSA. Different states are in different stages of both reporting versus screening, and it's really a in some ways, a real change in the way we approach medicine. That is, it's really the first time I think medical care has been so specifically insisted upon by legislative mandates versus having general quality measures or guidance from JCO, HCPAC, and other national agencies. So I'll switch us from the hospital setting, which is where all of this is largely occurring. There is one state at least that is insisting that nursing homes screen as well. But I'm going to switch over to the nursing home because there is a real dearth of data in the nursing homes. More and more are being done to understand the impact of MRSA in nursing homes. But I'm going to go over kind of the state of the data for nursing homes here. These data are range from very old studies over the past 15 years to fairly new studies. Again, not all of these are done in the same country, but in general it suggests that MRSA carriage among nursing home admissions is substantial, and this isn't surprising. These are in generally fairly ill patients, and it ranges from about 10 to 15%, and as I mentioned, in more recent studies may be as high as 30 to 40%. There are even higher, some studies that suggest higher, but I think overall this is the general sense that it's in this range. Again, this is, so instead of moving from carriage among nursing home admissions, again, that's importation, now moving to total prevalence in the nursing homes, you can see that there's this range across different hospitals that range somewhere between 5% and then again all the way up to 30 to 35% of people being positive. And if you look at studies that have done complex assessments of how much MRSA is acquired, again, this always is difficult because it requires serial swabbing, those range somewhere between 3 and 11% of MRSA acquisition. And again, I'll say that a lot more needs to be done and is being done in looking at the amount of transmission in nursing homes and how much of an interplay really exists between hospitals and nursing homes, which is an area that that I'm keenly interested in. So I'll move on to the next slide, and I'm going to talk briefly about how the MRSA reservoir is changing. And so you have kind of given you a picture about how much MRSA is there in hospitals and a little bit of the data that shows what's going on in nursing homes. But the truth is we're really seeing a rapid change in the number of people who are positive for MRSA and the number of people who are being seen for MRSA-related illness because of the rapid expansion of the community-associated strain. So in contrast to what people originally were worried about 10 years ago, which is that MRSA is rising so much in the hospital setting that we're afraid it's going to spill over into the community and cause a big problem. Instead of that happening, what's happening is just the opposite. A new strain arose in the community about in several different times, but you know, somewhere over 15 and 20 years ago, and then slowly has been spreading to the point where now it's rapidly spreading, and we're seeing that the community reservoir is actually now coming into the hospital and nursing home settings and producing a shift in the distribution of strains in the MRSA reservoir. And so I'll show you some data to this effect and give you just a brief mention about why some of these strains are maybe particularly concerning. This slide is a slide, again, from the CDC, from the NHANES study, and this is a really impressive study that goes about swabbing a really representative sample of people across the U.S. They do it in a very sophisticated statistical way of sampling people, both by geography and patient person population density, and they swab people in outpatient settings, so outpatient healthcare settings. And this is what they found. So in 2001, 2002, they generally found that, you know, MRSA, it's higher in as you get older. Some of that, of course, is because of healthcare-associated risk factors. But overall, their risk is somewhere around 0.8%. And if you then do the same thing and swab a bunch of people, again, these are all ages, in 2003 and 4, that number has essentially doubled at 1.5%. And you might say, well, that sounds like a really, really low number compared to the hospital. And you're absolutely right. But in terms of sheer quantity, you know, of course, there are many more people who are in the community than there are in the hospital. And so this actually amounts to a real large volume of people who are present throughout the U.S. This next slide shows you the emergency ID net data that really shows that purulent soft tissue infections that are presenting to emergency departments have really changed in their distribution, so that by 2004, MRSA really took over and was the most dominant pathogen across the U.S. for skin and soft tissue diseases that needed to be drained. That is, if there was pus that could be cultured, it was cultured. And when they did that, 59% of pathogens were MRSA. And 97% of those pathogens of MRSA were due to this community-associated strain. And so it goes and shows you how you can take a small prevalence in the community in terms of what's in people's noses, 1 to 2%, and really have a huge impact on emergency departments because those 1-2% of people, which are a large number of people, when they start to scrape themselves or bruise themselves or just by chance have something go awry and the organism goes into a portal of entry, are now presenting throughout the U.S. into a number of emergency departments, and I'm really seeing a much, much higher proportion of people with MRSA disease than we have encountered in the past. The next slide is a summary slide just to tell you a little bit about the differences between community-associated MRSA and healthcare-associated MRSA. The first is that community-associated MRSA really is defined as having no known risk factors, and there are five major risk factors that have been defined by the CDC through Scott Fridkin's work largely. And of course, those include things like recent hospitalizations, recent stay in a nursing home or rehab center, recent major surgery, indwelling Lyme, hemodialysis. So there are a set of risk factors that are, have kind of been identified as the healthcare-associated risk factors. And if you don't have any of those, then they'll say, okay, you know, it looks like you probably have a community-associated picture. Now, of course, this is to be distinguished between what now has come up in the forefront as what we call community onset and healthcare onset. That is, we just use a fixed day cutoff to say, is this coming in from the community or really starting in the hospital? But to really distinguish between what we call associated, community-associated, and healthcare-associated, you really need to do this extra survey work and ask the patient about where they've been and what kind of exposures they've had. The strains are different. So for community-associated MRSA, these are by pulse field gel analysis, the USA 300 and 400 strains, compared to what has been traditionally the USA 100 and 200 strains in the hospital arena. So it is a different strain, and with it carries some very important implications. Initially, in the very beginning of the community-associated expansion, community-associated MRSA was known to be highly clonal. It still remains highly clonal, although it's starting to diverge. And it was known to be very antibiotic sensitive. So what do I mean by that? Well, in general, MRSA is called MRSA because it's methicillin resistant. That is, it is resistant to all the beta-lactams, penicillins, and all of its cousins, the cephalosporins, the carbapenems, all of those classes are out. But the healthcare-associated MRSA also has a good amount of resistance to other drugs, like the fluoroquinolone class, Bactrim, clindamycin, erythromycin, and that really was not initially seen in the community-associated strains. That is, it was really beta-lactam, and everything else looked pretty good. And what's been happening is that those profiles have been merging, but in the very beginning of this story, you could distinguish between community-associated strains and healthcare-associated strains by looking at the antibiogram. The PVL toxin is a toxin that is called the pantine-valentine leukocytin toxin, and it has been implicated in producing necrosis and soft tissue damage. And so we know that this toxin is much more common in the community-associated variants than in the healthcare-associated variants. And we believe that that may be explaining why skin and soft tissue is the dominant form of infection in community-associated MRSA. My personal bias is that skin and soft tissue is the major form because people in the community are doing things like toddlers are falling down or scraping themselves, people in gyms are getting bruises and nicks, and so some of, or in football teams and other high-contact sports. So some of this is just exposure. But it is true that once it sets up shop in the commonplace of skin and soft tissue, it does seem to have an unusual predilection for producing necrotizing infection. That is a true pus pocket, tissue death, and a real need for clean out. The next slide is just to show you that these antibiotic profiles are truly emerging and that you really can't tell anymore that what used to be called the pan-susceptible MRSA really doesn't exist in many places anymore. That is, the community-associated strains really are not highly susceptible in many places. And just two more slides about community-associated MRSA. Oh, actually, a couple more slides before I'll return back to healthcare-associated disease. This slide, which is a snapshot of a paper done by Lauren Miller. It was a New England Journal article, and I will just mention it because it highlights that not only are the strain distributions changing, but the clinical manifestations of disease are changing. So before this past decade, I would say that necrotizing fasciitis, which is a flesh-eating bacteria-type disease, necrotizing fasciitis was really considered extremely rare, nearly unheard of by Staph aureus. It really was not a pathogen that was implicated in this disease. And then Lauren Miller's group and others have shown that necrotizing fasciitis became a very common mode of MRSA rearing its ugly head. So they presented, I think, something close to 16 cases over a year, a real phenomenal amount of necrotizing fasciitis caused by community-associated MRSA. And so it's just to highlight to you that these types of strains do tend to produce more necrotizing disease and that it is becoming more common in ways that we have not previously experienced. Similarly, this MMWR paper came out suggesting that post-influenza staph infection, which is well known, well understood, even well before MRSA, that after influenza, if you're going to get a super infection with a bacterial disease, it's often staph aureus. But now what they're seeing is that there are MRSA super infections that seem to be highly necrotizing, and that these pneumonias tend to have a lot of tissue destruction and be quite severe and can result in death. And so whether or not this is really a manifestation of community-associated MRSA becoming more prevalent, or whether or not we are now just heightened to look for it and to report it, is not yet clear, but the CDC is actually looking into it to see how these disease distributions are changing. The next slide is a slide by again, by the CDC, that was a really highly anticipated paper that came out in JAMA in 2007, and it shows that invasive MRSA cases, a lot of them are starting in the community, but a lot of these people have healthcare risk factors. So because hospital days are short, everybody goes home, and then everything looks like it's kind of a de novo presentation on arrival to the hospital, but a good number of these are still healthcare associated. So if you look at the pie, you can divide MRSA severe invasive disease, that is in a sterile site, blood, CSF, pleural space, that's reported to certain areas of the country report to the CDC. This is known as the ABC's network. If you look at the amount that they're reporting, you can see that 27% are truly hospital onset. This is from 2004 and 5, and that means these are what we would traditionally consider to be nosocomial. If you then look at the rest of the large pie, you can see that true community-associated cases are only 14%. And then there's this very large portion, 58% of all these cases look like they start in the community. That is, they're identified on arrival or within 48 hours of admission. But if you actually query these patients, they have healthcare-associated risk factors. And so it's really telling us that a lot of things, this picture, we can't use our usual judgment. Things that come in on day one are not always community-associated. And things that are community-associated, though, MRSA is not always derived from a healthcare setting. And so it's a really mixed picture now of what's going on both in the community and in the hospital setting. And there is data, although I'm not going to present it here, that suggests that a lot of hospitals are experiencing that a good number of their nosocomial strains are the community-associated strain now, which was not expected. Similarly, USA 300, which is the community associated strain, is also being seen now in nursing homes. And so there are some very recent studies and an abstract of people who are looking in nursing homes and finding that people are colonized with this community associated variant. So again, all reservoirs appear to be mixing, nursing home reservoirs, hospital reservoirs, and then this new community reservoir that's really been surging over the past decade. So in the last 15 minutes, I'd like to quickly go over some potential responses of what can you do. And again, there's a lot to be said about each of these. I'm really just skimming the surface. But I'll give you some of the data, and there are some references that if you have a great desire to read more, they're probably good references to go to. So there are a variety of responses that people can do. The most common one, and again, the most widely publicized one, and the one that's in the public's eyes, is this idea of screening and isolating patients. And I have a little cartoon here that says, you know, the patient in the next bed is highly infectious. Thank God for these curtains. And those of you in the hospital epidemiology field understand that curtains tend to be a real source of question of cleaning and how much might reside there. And of course, we know that, you know, there's a lot of environmental contamination in a number of ways. And so there's a lot that can be done to prevent infections in general. So the next slide is a paper that we actually published that looked at the impact of routine screening on admission and weekly in 8 ICUs in a tertiary care center. This is about a 750-bed tertiary care hospital in Boston. And you can see that over this time period, which is about 9 years, that there was really an inexorable increase in our amount of MRSA bacteremias. And these are discrete events, so, you know, not someone who's had bacteremia for 12 days in a row, but discrete events. And you can see that they are rising over time between 1996 and September 1. And we had instituted what we consider now the traditional line bundle and alcohol hand rub at a variety of points in time. And of course, these aren't geared specifically to MRSA, and there was no real abatement in our increase in MRSA bacteremia. And then we had a hand hygiene campaign, and this little blip, the first blip that you see is actually not significant after the alcohol hand rub. There looks to be a slight decline, and then it bounces right back up, and we try to enforce it with a hand hygiene campaign and really didn't see much improvement. And then what you see around September 03, when we did this nearly instantaneous through physician ordering cultures of ICU patients, that there was a dramatic decline in the incidence density of MRSA bacteremia. And this occurred not only in the ICU, but also in the non-ICU areas. And our interpretation of this is that the timing would suggest that screening of people and putting them in rapid isolation prevented other people from being exposed, and those other people who now didn't have MRSA that they would have gotten cannot incur the 1 in 3 chance of a downstream invasive event, and that is why we're seeing a decline in our bacteremias. So this is just one study in one particular population that suggests a substantial benefit from screening and isolation. The next slide is another study from the VA Pittsburgh suggesting, again, a dramatic improvement in the incidence density of MRSA in a surgical ICU. There's another slide after that. This, again, is a widely well-known study done very recently by Ari Robichek's group. This is Lance Peterson's group in the Northwestern healthcare system, showing a benefit using Poisson regression after they instituted ICU screening. When you look at the amount of MRSA that they're seeing, and then they went actually house-wide, and you can see the reduction after they did universal screening. And the next slide I'll just show you, this is data from Germany. And these are all different studies that use different types of comparisons and analytic assessments, but here they're showing you, you can see these gray bars, which is the incidence of people with MRSA infection, really declines after they put in a screening period. So there are, these are just a number of kind of the recently highlighted papers that would suggest that in certain circumstances in high-risk groups, it looks like screening appears to have a substantial benefit. And again, I'm not going to talk about the resource costs or the unintended consequences of screening. I'm going to move on to decolonization just in the interest of time and to tell you a little bit that, you know, people were saying, well, screening doesn't help the people who have it. It just prevents people who don't have it and keeps them negative. So, you know, what can we do for people who have it, who've really incurred this risk that I've been mentioning, this 1 in 3 risk in high-risk patients of having downstream disease? And so the first thing I'll mention is that MRSA is carried for a long time. And we know that the half-life is somewhere between 6 months and 40 months. And that strain typing studies have shown that patients generally carry a dominant strain, but they can carry multiple minority strains. And we've shown that people who tend to get repeat MRSA infection, I'm not talking about relapse, you know, insufficient therapy, but true repeat infection, completely discrete events, tend to get repeat infection from the same strain. And so some work that we've done suggests that about 75% of the time, it's exactly the same strain. And that suggests that we really don't generate as humans strain-specific immunity. And it raises a lot of questions about what should be done. So, you know, if it's the same strain that's harbored over a long time, then there's a real benefit of considering decolonization regimens. If it's different strains over time, then it suggests that it's just the environment that you're in. You're picking up somebody else's strain on a frequent basis. So the fact that they're fairly the same, it suggests that decolonization might be helpful. And the question really is, you know, what regimen? And a number of different regimens have been used. And I've just highlighted here that in general, some people use mupirocin alone. Some people do chlorhexidine bathing. Probably most people are headed in this domain of mixing mupirocin and chlorhexidine as a regimen. And there have been some studies, some very large studies recently, that have looked at systemic agents, oral antibiotics. And again, the side effect profiles of these suggest that this probably will not be used widely in the U.S. Mupirocin, this is a study done in the VA nursing home that I'm just highlighting here that it suggested, this and other studies have suggested that mupirocin will eradicate MRSA fairly quickly, but then there is a substantial risk of reacquisition over time. And so there's some concern also that mupirocin resistance has been rising in certain areas. And in fact, some places like Dave Warren's group in WashU have actually shown that resistance can rise even in the absence of a lot of mupirocin use. And so there is a real question now about the longevity of mupirocin utility, but it is still in many ways the first line agent that's used to produce clearance. Of course, we know that Staph aureus doesn't just sit in the nose, it also can get on the skin, especially in people who are chronically or critically ill. And so there's a real push to look at mupirocin plus chlorhexidine. And again, it is probably the most common regimen that's used today. And there are a variety of studies that I'm just touching on, but the citations are there, that suggest that you can substantially reduce the amount of MRSA incidence density in a unit and certainly skin colonization. This is another study by Seymour et al. Recently in 2007 showing a divergence in the amount of MRSA that's retained if you use topical plus oral plus bathing regimens to clear people. So I'll just move on to that last slide in the decolonization comment, which is the most common regimen is to use intranasal mupirocin twice a day for about 5 to 7 days with concomitant chlorhexidine bathing at about 2%. Solution at 2% cloth is what's mostly used at 5 to 7 days. So and then they have a variety of reasons, regimens where they suggest different levels of serial screening to really determine that someone is truly negative. Usually it is three negative cultures done on at least 3 different days where you screen both the nares and any prior colonized site unless it's too invasive to get a culture like blood. I have one slide on vaccinations, and I'll just mention that there was a very nice vaccine trial that was done that was really a proof of concept, but it didn't bear out in subsequent trials, and there are really no imminent candidates. There are a few that are being highly sought after by commercial companies, but it's sad to say that there are some real difficulties in Staph aureus. It is a much more elusive organism than you would expect. It tends to have a different appearance, is probably the best word, a different coat that's visual, that's provided when it's in the bloodstream versus when it's in tissues, and there's just a lot of issues about why a vaccine is not going to be available in the very near future. And then I'll quickly run through this idea of disinfection. There really is a good literature about environmental contamination of MRSA. It gets all over the place, doorknobs, beds, rails, phones, counters, tables. And, you know, in general, we've really felt as a field that, you know, patient-to-patient contact, hand hygiene, getting it on gowns and gloves and stethoscopes white coats is probably the dominant mode of transmission. And I think that is generally still believed. I think, however, the thoughts that the environment might produce a very small component versus a more substantial component is now being questioned, where people used to say, well, it's clearly contaminated, but it produces such a very small proportion of risk. I think that there's some evidence climbing that it might still be the lesser evil, but it may not be as tiny as people previously thought. So environmental contamination, again, lots of studies showing that this readily occurs. And there's a really nice abstract that was presented in Shea this past year showing that it doesn't matter if you're colonized or infected, the amount of contamination in the room is the same. So again, really suggesting that the value of doing contact precautions is that, you know, it's not just for infected people. People who are colonized will shed MRSA and produce a risk for transmission as much as someone who's infected. And the issues with common cleaning issues is that, you know, no one really can do the 10-minute wet contact time. That's the general FDA-approved standard. Often the assessment of whether or not a room is clean is visual, and there are a lot of time pressures. A lot of times there's a need to turn over the room in less time than is really adequately needed to clean. There's also a large number of issues related to what I will call orphan items, that is, items that move around like glucometers and other mobile objects that are not born under environmental services and may not be really assigned to a group for cleaning. So there's been some really nice work, and I'm looking at the time, really nice work done by Phil Carling. We've done one study, but I'll really have to highlight Phil Carling's work. He has developed a black light marker. This is something that's invisible but will glow under black light, and he's used it in a number of hospitals. I've listed here 40, but actually well more than that. In fact, he has a recent study in ITCHI, Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, that describes this benefit across numerous hospitals, where he's placed this marker on a variety of well-defined objects and then gone back over time to see whether or not environmental services has adequately removed it. This black light marker has been designed to be removed with what you would consider to be adequate cleaning, that is, by a very moist rag. It's very easily removed, or by substantial pressure with an only damp rag. So in my mind, having worked with it, it is a really nice process measure about whether something is being cleaned. And he's done some work here, again, as one of his citations, some work showing that, you know, these variety of room items, bedside table, toilet handle, call box, you can see that previous to giving feedback with this black light marker, certain things were very poorly cleaned, and then getting them really nicely cleaned after the black light marker is instituted. And it's really one of the things in infection control. Infection control generally has a hard time sustaining a benefit. So many of us can get our hand hygiene rates to get close to 90% for a while, and then things kind of come back down again as the campaign ends and as people kind of get used to things again. But this black light marker, it's really impressive. He's been able to show some real longevity as long as the feedback is provided even in a fairly infrequent way. And I'll just highlight that some of this idea is that, you know, before people used to use a real bucket, they would immerse a cloth and clean things so that there was a good amount of contact time and that the disinfectant was applied in a fairly sizable manner. And then people have moved to pour bottles and spray bottles, you know, to prevent smell and other things, and that's actually resulted in some ways in worse disinfection. And so there's a push by some centers, and some of our work has suggested that an intervention that has relied upon going back to the bucket method has actually produced less MRSA and VRE by culturing rooms. So I'll just highlight that comment here. And at last, of course, you know, education is really important, and I don't want to leave it for last among a long list of things that could possibly be done. There's some really nice patient education materials that exist at the CDC, some really nice posters that can be done, and education really is a huge component of making people understand what level of concern should be had, and not to have undue panic, but to really think about how we can contain this pathogen. So in conclusion, MRSA is really endemic and sometimes hyper-endemic in hospitals, nursing homes, and in the community today. I know I've highlighted the U.S. as the dominant data source, but it really is true in large amounts of areas, including South America, Europe, and Asia. And morbidity and mortality is quite high among the very sick. So I'll again highlight the critically and chronically ill. It is really staggering, and I think there's a great need to have interventions in those areas, in addition to the general desire to have an intervention in community areas, for example. Community and healthcare reservoirs are absolutely merging, and they are continuing to expand. So what we're doing is not working completely. Some things are working well in certain areas, and we just need to learn more from one another about what the right thing is. And I don't know if we have good scientific evidence that there is a one-size-fits-all policy. There might be, and it may well be that that's the strategy that people have to move towards, but I don't think we really have the scientific evidence to say that we know that for sure. But nevertheless, legislation and public reporting have arrived, and I know I haven't touched at all on metrics, but that is a whole other field about how can we publicly report well, not just so that things are well understood by the public, but that we do, we really are assured that we can compare things across sites, and that's a real issue because of case mix and because of the way we select our metrics. And finally, there are several options for response, and I do think that, you know, resources are increasingly limited, and facilities do need to understand what is best for them. However, we do know that certain high-risk groups really can benefit from well established interventions that will reduce MRSA overall. So thank you very much for your attention. You know, I recognize that this doesn't allow a kind of an interactive response for me to answer a lot of questions, but I just wanted to thank you all for your attention, and I hope this has been helpful.
Dr. Huang, thank you very much. That has been tremendously helpful. You covered some things there that I wasn't aware of in the past, and even in some of your passing comments, you say things that I thought, well, gosh, that's so obvious. Why didn't I notice that before? Thank you for that. It's very well presented. You mentioned environmental contamination issues and the question of curtains and so on. I reread one of your articles recently. It's a 2006 article on the risk of acquiring antibiotic-resistant bacteria from prior room occupants. And you really point out the environmental risk, that we used to think that the environment is not the issue. It's hands and it's equipment. But the environment is such a big issue, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the dominant issue. You know, our paper, so that the paper, for those who haven't read it, just briefly, is to say, you know, if you're admitted to an ICU, does it matter if you go into a room where the prior occupant was positive or the prior occupant was negative? You know, we assume that post-discharge cleaning is perfect. And the truth is, we actually found a difference in our intensive care units in Boston, and we found that, you know, there was a 40% increased risk of you acquiring MRSA or VRE if you went to a room that where the previous positive person was positive. Now, the risk is small. That is, it went from something like, you know, a couple of percent to a couple of more percent. So the overall, the percent is low. And overall, in terms of all the risk of acquiring it, you know, the environment, that particular mode, and that, of course, doesn't cover all the environment. It doesn't cover common spaces. It doesn't cover a fomite that's circulating bronchoscopes. But that particular issue of being placed in a room where the prior person was an occupant was only about accounted for about 5% of all acquisitions. Needless to say, it's a little disconcerting. So even if it's 5%, you might say, well, that doesn't make me feel a whole lot better, that if I go into a room that I have to care about who was there before me. So, you know, our chief medical officer wasn't happy with those results, and that put us on, there's a couple more papers after that that showed that we did a very large black light marker environmental cleaning study, and then we have recent results now that are probably going to be hopefully accepted for abstract at this upcoming SHEA that suggests that we actually show that some of those disparities go away after a very rigorous environmental cleaning intervention. So I think the answer is that it is not going to be the dominant form, but it's more than we think, and that, you know, we really do need to think about multiple pronged attacks about how we can clean pathogens in general. And, you know, I won't restrict my comments just to MRSA, but, you know, a number of pathogens as we get into more and more issues with drug resistance.
Certainly the housekeeping issue is something that is completely controllable by us. We may not be able to control the antibiotic use in the environment or animal feed, that sort of thing, but we can certainly control how we clean if it's something that's within our control.
Yeah, you would think so. I think it takes a lot of giving them the kudos that they need to clean properly and having a real environment of multidisciplinary way of people saying, I understand that I want this room in 5 minutes, but you need 30 minutes to clean
right.
It, you know, and a lot of education on their role and how important it really is.
Great. Thank you all very much for your attention today. And Dr. Huang, thank you very, very much. This is really an interesting presentation, and I hope we might be able to call upon you again in the future, maybe give you a little bit more advanced notice than we did,
than we did
on this one. And to all, I look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.